The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. I think we're pretty close here, but members, we have a very full agenda for today. We're going to skip around a little bit here. We're going to go to the Detmer bills first, and then we're going to look at all the Social Security bills, 300, 304, 308, 309, 746, at the same time here. So, Representative Detmer, welcome to committee, and we will, like I said, we'll call a quorum as soon as we have it. I'm going to be turning the gavel over to the vice chair for a time. I have a bill up in one of my very favorite committees, government operations, so we'll see how that goes. So I'll turn it over to Vice Chair Detmer, or Detmer, Barrett. For the Detmer bill.
Representative Detmer, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 312.
We can start with that one, Mr. Chair.
House File 312 was moved for presentation in front of the committee.
Okay. Just don't know which button to push here. So, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 312, you probably will find out it's very similar to another bill that I presented a couple weeks ago, House File 137. House File 312, I did a delete all amendment in the Veterans Division, and basically it's the same bill as 137, except it's a phase-in to bring it into for our veterans that are retired, and allows House File 312. Basically, if you take a look at the country, you have a document in front of you from the research department that Nina Manzi put forward earlier this year, and the following table summarizes the taxation of military retirement income across the states. And if you could take a look at that right now, it might give you a little good some background on what's going on in other states and what we're trying to do here in Minnesota, Mr. Chair. And of the 50 states in District Columbia, 9 do not have general income tax. And the remaining 42 states, 35 exempt at least a portion of the military retirement income, and 3 provide credits for retirement income. And 2 of the 3 states that provide credits also allow for limit exemption. That leaves about 6 states that do not exempt any portion of the military retirement income since the tax year 2009. Now, Minnesota has provided a credit, which is a $750 credit, but that phases out after a person's income gets over $30,000. So that pretty much exempts most veterans except for those that are at a very low income. And there's 15 states that fully exclude military retirement income from taxable income. 11 states exclude a fixed amount of military retirement income, which House File 312 will do. And 9 states, including Minnesota, has some type of pension income. And on the next page, you can see what kind of takes all the states and names them and gives you a pretty good document that is put together for us by the research department. And then you also have another document, if I can find it here.
And Representative Detmer, if I could just interrupt you for a second. We do have a quorum now, so I'll officially move House File 312 for presentation before the committee. And also one other bit of housekeeping. We have minutes of February 26th to approve. Can I get a motion for approval of those minutes?
So
Representative McDonald moves the minutes of February 26th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those against, same sign. Motion is approved and the minutes have been adopted. Back to you, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to turn it over to Ralph Donais, that most of you are familiar with him. He comes up to the Capitol a lot to talk on veterans issues. And he would like to address House File 312.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Donais. If you could state your name officially for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Representatives. My name is Ralph Donais. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council, and I'm here today to talk on Representative Detmer's bill. As you may know from past testimonies that I've given in many committees, the military spends billions of dollars training military people in all different facets that we can use here in Minnesota. And the problem we're running into is many of the people who are really qualified and could help Minnesota businesses are not coming back to Minnesota due to our taxation of their pensions. As Representative Detmer implied, there are many states that do not tax their pensions, and that's where many of them are going. Currently, Wisconsin brings into their state economy more than $51 million each year than Minnesota does. The reason being, they went tax exempt back in 2000. Since 2000, up until the data that I could get a hold of from 2013, Wisconsin has gained over $440 million more than Minnesota has in their economy. I think it's time that we bring Minnesota into the light of all the states that we want those people to come back. Myself, my son-in-law, my daughter will not come back to Minnesota. He's a military retiree, and he says he's going to go live in a state where his pension is exempt. And so I ask that all of you consider not so much for the people that are here, but for the people that we want to draw to Minnesota. Most military retirees have a college degree, as such do I. So basically, to me, you're saying we don't want all these people that have college degrees and all this training and everything that they've acquired over 20 years. We want them to go to other states. And I think it's time that we say Minnesota wants you to come back to Minnesota, or for those that have never been here, we want you to come to Minnesota to be a new resident in our state. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Donais. Is there, Representative Detmer, do you have any other folks coming in to testify on your behalf?
This will be it, because the committee has heard this, basically this bill before, except now it's a phase-in. And if you take a look at the revenue note, there's a income, the revenue note here, and the bill provides subtraction for the Minnesota taxable income and Minnesota alternative minimum taxable income for qualified individuals. And basically what the first year, when you sit down and do your taxes, you'll be able to get deduct up to $500 per year of service. Now, I put a cap on as 20 years. In the military, you have to serve 20 years to start drawing in military retirement. And unless you are medically retired, which this bill will also cover, or during the Clinton years, there were several people that served in the military that were forced to retire at 18 years. We have a few of those in Minnesota. So, and then for fiscal year 2017, it would go up to $1,000 per year of service, and then so it just phases it in. And I think this is something that probably Minnesota will be able to work through and get this through for people serving. There's another document that you would have in front of you, shows you the military retirees in Minnesota by rank as of September 30th, 2014. And as you can see, we only have one four-star general that lives in Minnesota. But we have a lot enlisted and also younger soldiers that we would like to see stay here in Minnesota. And right now, about 60% of the retired veterans that have 20 years that live in Minnesota are in their 60s, over 60. So, also another document that you have in front of you, it's the Minnesota House of Representatives, the House Research Department. It's the Minnesota Tax Treatment Pensions. It shows you back in 1933, when the Minnesota Income Tax was an enacted exclusion program, and then shows you what happened over the years, 41, 51, and so forth. In 1987, the pension exclusion was repealed. So it kind of gives you a little history of our how we treated our pensions here in Minnesota. And does anybody know that there's still one pension that we don't tax in Minnesota? The railroad. The railroad, still their pensions, the people that work for the railroad, their pensions are not taxed here in Minnesota. So just a point there. But anyway, I'd like to have your support, and hopefully we can do something for people serving in our military this year.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify in favor of the bill, have concerns about the bill, or would like to act in the capacity of a resource about the bill? Seeing none, any questions of the committee? Representative Wells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Detmer, for authoring this bill. And I also signed on to it and very supportive of this effort. And just a question, and you kind of alluded to it. How often do you see someone retire from the military at a younger age and then go into private sector work? And how would this bill affect that?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
And Representative Will, you know, that's after you spend 20 years in the military, you've acquired a lot of skills, leadership, and I know when my sons graduate from West Point, there was corporations, businesses right there handing out their business cards and say, hey, when you decide to leave the military, we want you. And regardless if you're an academy graduate or if you are a long-time non-commissioned officer or other officers, those are the type of people you would like to see stay in your state and start second careers. They'll be maybe starting businesses. They'll hire other people. They're going to buy homes. They'll buy vehicles. Now their children can and their spouse can use their Montgomery GI benefits for college education. A lot of money, as we spoke about before, will come into the state. And that's one thing a fiscal note or revenue note doesn't talk about. When you get people that come into your state, maybe it's costing us some in tax revenue, but what do they bring into the state? And this is something that I've always thought was really important, that we have an environment here that people want to come to Minnesota, stay here, and build a life here. So, good question.
Representative Wells, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Representative Detmer, for the explanation, and I think that's just an added reason why it's so important to do this bill and to encourage veterans to either retire here if they're already residents or to come to Minnesota to retire from the military to be able to get into the private sector and become tax-paying citizens here in Minnesota. And the bill I authored for a veterans hiring tax credit, I think, goes hand in hand with what you're trying to do here. So I commend your bill and I support it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Demmer.
Interesting. Iowa last session, Iowa legislature just got rid of their tax on their veterans. And it was. And I mentioned this before. I had a good discussion during the groundbreaking ceremony for the bridge from Stillwater over into Wisconsin. And I walked up to Governor Walker and talked about what we're trying to do here in Minnesota for our veterans. And, of course, he already shared, he shared with me that what they're already doing for veterans. And then he, with a smile on his face, he said, you know, what we'd like to do in Wisconsin, maybe just get rid of income tax. And I looked at him, and he smiled back. And I looked at where the bridge is going up, and I said, well, that bridge might be pretty busy going from west to east. He just laughed. But these are some things that we can do, especially for those who have served for many years, many over 20 years in our military.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wouldn't it be more attractive for veterans with a lot of skills if they have them if we had a military industrial complex here that would attract them, which we don't have a lot of, we may have a few things, and I think some of these states that are attracting veterans, they can plug into what really is available. And I don't know that we have those kind of things here. I mean, we have nice weather and those kind of things, and nice outdoors, but we don't have a lot of, skill. I think I mentioned this once before, Representative, the only thing I learned in the service was blowing things up, and that there's nothing that fits into anything in that I can see. And, if I'd come out of the service and try to find a job blowing things up, I'd be in jail.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, if you look at whether it's Air Force, Marines, Army, Navy, there's so many different MOSs, military occupational specialties, that they get training in, whether it's firefighting. You know, if you're aboard of a ship, everyone's a firefighter there. If you're EMT, the training that you have in combat, and also you're just engineering and your construction. I know a lot of jobs require these skills, and just look at all the construction that's going on. And one thing that I've learned, that, and also people who hire veterans, is that they're willing to learn. And if they might not have that skill that they want at the time, they know how to work and they know how to learn different skills. And they've got the training and they know how to follow directions, and they're dedicated.
Representative Earhart, follow up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, those are all admirable characteristics, which are not only produced by the military, but other things as well, education and community activity and so forth. So I don't think that the veterans are necessarily endowed with those by their service time, though they may have been, some of them.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Earhart, I know one thing that I learned my 25 years in the military is that one thing that I didn't learn in college when I got my degree in education and teaching, and that's until I got into the career, is leadership. And that's one thing you learn real quickly, is that you learn how to lead other people. First of all, you learn how to follow. And then you learn how to lead, after following, taking orders. And then you learn how to develop orders and follow through with things with the men and women that serve underneath you. And that's one thing that businesses are looking for, is leadership.
Any other questions from committee members? Representative Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I just want to say that certainly it's hard to generalize about any particular group of people, but I have had veterans work for me, and I've had a very good experience when I have hired veterans.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. Any other questions of the committee? Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Detmer, does this apply to active members of the National Guard or those who are serving in the reserve but aren't considered veterans because they haven't been on federal deployment?
Representative Depp.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, yes, it does. It's as long as you get your 20 years in or you're medically retired, you'll be drawing a retirement through the federal government. And again, that's bringing that money to Minnesota if they decide to move here and stay here. So whether you're National Guard or reserve component, it accounts for everybody that are receiving retirement through the federal government.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Detmer, this is the first time we've heard this bill before, but the first time I've seen sort of the retirees sorted out by pay grade and what branch of the military they've served in. And for those of us who are less familiar with the military, these, you know, E1 through 9 and W1 through 5 and 01 to 10 don't really translate real well. Okay. And, you know, it would be really a nice addition before we put together the final tax bill if we could get what that means in terms of an average pension within those classes, so we'd know if the tax forgiveness is, you know, for most of them 100% of their pension or it's a portion of their pension. It would be really nice to be able to put this in perspective. Thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, first of all, E just means enlisted. E1 is when you first come into the military, and usually if you retire as enlisted, you might be retired as an E5, E6, E7, maybe up to an E9, but there's only a few. As you get higher in ranks, there's just fewer numbers. W's means warrant officers. Warrant officer 1 when you first become a warrant officer, and then warrant officer 5, there's just a few of those. Then your officers, your O's, all the way up to O10. And there's just, as you get higher in rank, there's just fewer and fewer of those people that are at those ranks. And when you get to 20 years as an enlisted or a warrant officer, you're probably enlisted at like an E6, E7 as a warrant officer, as an enlisted E6 or 7 as a warrant officer, probably a W3, W4. But again, there's only so many slots available. And one thing that you realize that you many times, as an officer, if you don't make your next promotion, you might miss two promotion events, and then you might be required to retire, or leave the military. So there's different regulations for different ranks. So to answer your question, could we put together something that shows you retirement? I'd have to check with the Department of Defense to see if we can put that together in terms of retirement. I can tell you what their pay is, but not necessarily what their retirement would be, because it's based on retirement points. To get a good year in retirement, you got to have at least 50 points, and you get in the Guard and the Reserve, you get 48 for just for your drills, your weekend drills. You get like four points per weekend, and then you just add those up over a number of years, and then depends on what rank you are, you might get 30 cents per point or 40 cents per point, depends on your rank. And so if you're at active duty, you get 365 points per year. So most reservists and National Guards, they'll acquire about anywhere from 50 to 80 or 90 points per year.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would really like to see, even if it's a range, because I think it's fair for us to know if we're going to be giving someone up to $30,000 of their taxes, their income, tax-free under this bill. We need to know, is that 100% of their pension? Is that a portion of it? And really, how does that relate to their household income? And so if you could do that, that would be great. And if it has to be a range, we know that.
Yeah.
Well, Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I will check with the Military Affairs and the Department of Veterans Affairs, see if they've got a breakdown on that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Detmer. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Detmer, I'm looking at the E1 grade on the sheet you passed out, and I see 22 E1s who are military retirees. Can you tell me how many of those are medical boards? I can't imagine there are any E1s that made it to 20 years unless they were really, really naughty.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, I looked at that too, and it's probably medically retired. Maybe they're injured in training even. So,
Representative Lesch?
Mr. Chair and Representative Denver, I think I asked you this too on Veterans Affairs. Can you tell me what percentage of veterans in Minnesota make it to 20 years to qualify for this benefit as proposed?
Representative Denver.
Mr. Chair, well, we have 370,000 veterans in Minnesota, and at this point, there's 4.7% of those are retired that are actually drawing that are not necessarily withdrawing right now, because as a Guard or Reserve, you got to be at the age 60. So we have about 18,000 retired veterans in Minnesota, between 18,000 and 19,000. So in terms of that are actually drawing, I would say it's more like maybe 17, between 17 and 18,000 that are actually drawing retirement.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, you know I made no bones in the past about finding a way that, you know, these folks are already getting a substantial benefit in the sense of a federal pension. And I feel like the, you know, whether it's the 80% or 85% or 90% of veterans that we're leaving behind and not helping them out. And I understand the reason for that is because the way the federal law is set, where you're either in or you're out at 20 years or 18 years, as in that one case. But I just feel like this proposal conveys a benefit to those who were able to make it all the way through for 20, and it leaves the rest of our veterans behind. And I'd like us to find a way to help them out in this bill that we're not.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I was thinking here as I was looking around the room that there is a place that some veterans can plug in. There's Representative Dittmer and Representative Lesh, Representative Earhart, and maybe others in the room, so they can plug into the legislature if they so inclined. So that's one place. But then I was going to ask the question, Mr. Chairman. This is not discriminatory against women veterans. They get the same reductions if they are qualified as men in this reduction, right?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Reverend Earhart, yes. Ranks that, you know, there's everybody that serves in the military, and regardless what rank you are, you're treated the same, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Petersburg? No? Any other questions of the committee? All right. Chair renews my motion for House File 312 for possible inclusion in a tax omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Dettmer. Thank you, Mr. Dudonis. Next on the agenda is Representative Dettmer, House File 125.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 125 is basically identical to Representative Wills' bill, House File 10. And we've been working together on this, and I just wanted to, being that it's going forward in the Senate, I just wanted to make sure that we're hearing here in the House also.
And Representative Dettmer, I was negligent in not moving that House File 125 be presented before our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That now.
And again, it's similar to a bill that was vetoed in 2011 by Governor Dayton, and when it was included in the regular session tax bill, Representative Will introduced the identical bill in 2013 that passed the State Government Finance and the Veterans Affairs Committee, but it was stalled in the Tax Committee. There is a maximum credit for this is for employers that give them a maximum credit for hiring a veteran. A disabled veteran is $3,000 credit when you hire a disabled veteran. And the maximum credit allowed for hiring an unemployed veteran is $1,500. And the maximum credit allowing for hiring a veteran is $500. And so that's basically the gist of the bill. It gives incentives for employers, businesses to hire a veteran. I think you hear the commercials on the radio by Adjutant General Nash about hiring veterans, encouraging businesses out there to really look at hiring a veteran. This is, we'll just give an incentive for hiring a veteran. And with that, it's pretty much identical to House File 10.
Sounds good. Thank you, Representative Dettmer. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify in favor of the bill, have concerns for the bill, or would like to act as a resource to the committee? Seeing no one, any questions of the committee? Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dettmer, I'm just kind of wondering why you settled on the $500 credit, only the reduced credit for post-9/11 veterans.
Representative Dettmer.
I would ask the research to maybe address that, because there was a question before. Yes, Manzi?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, the bill, if a post-9/11 veteran is disabled and is hired by an employer, the employer would receive the $3,000 credit for hiring a disabled veteran. And if a post 9/11 veteran is unemployed at the time they're hired, then the employer would get the $1,500 credit for hiring an unemployed veteran. If a post 9/11 veteran is in one job and moving to another job, then the employer would get the $500 credit. What this bill does, sort of, I'd like to add, relative to Representative Will's bill, is it limits that $500 credit for people who are moving from one job to another to a veteran who it meets the definition of a post 9/11 veteran, which is a person who served in a qualified area, which would be a combat zone or a supporting qualified hazardous duty area, since September 11th. So we don't have House File 10 in the information in our packets today, but the revenue estimate for House File 10 is higher than the estimate for House File 125, since in House File 125, that $500 credit is limited to a smaller pool of veterans.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Representative Detmer, anything to add to that?
That was explained very well. It was explained to me once before, and that's why I asked for assistance to explain it here for the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Representative Moline, follow-up.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, that does clarify how that would work then for the post 9/11 veterans. I'm wondering, does PTSD count as disabled veteran? And if it does, what do you have to have a diagnosis of PTSD, or how does that work?
Representative Detmer.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not a medical doctor on this, but I can just say I'm assuming that if you're diagnosed with PTSD and determined as a disability, I think you would have to have records to show that. That would be my answer. I don't have a good answer for that. That's a good question.
Representative Moline.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, maybe we could get some more information on that. I would be interested to know if PTSD, if you are diagnosed with PTSD, if you are considered a disabled veteran. Maybe it's because it's my generation, but I, of course, have several friends that have served in Iraq and Afghanistan post 9/11 and have faced a number of employment issues. And I would want to make sure that, if it's PTSD that they're suffering from, that they would be considered disabled because of that, because if it happened during the combat period.
Mr. Chair, that's a good question.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, that's a good question, Representative Moline, and maybe we got partly of an answer here, too.
Sure. Representative Detmer, we're checking with staff here. Does staff at all have an answer to the good question by Representative Moline? Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Rubis has looked quickly, and it could qualify as a disability, but whether or not it made a person a disabled veteran for purposes of this tax credit would depend on whether or not that person had been determined to be disabled because of PTSD by the U.S. Veterans Administration. So I think in order to really get a good grasp of whether that happens and how often that happens, we're going to have to go back and do a little more research on it.
Mr. Chairman, just really quickly, this is Representative Groffel over here. I strenuously object to this committee ever using Mr. Rubis as a point of fact or any dispute in this committee. So
the committee will note Representative Groffalo's irritation at the use of...
Mr. Chair, that's a good point, though.
Representative Detmer.
That's a good point regarding if it's documented by the military, whether you have any type of injury. PTSD is post-traumatic stress is also part of that document as a disability. Yeah, you have that piece of paper that you carry with you as a disability, but it has to be documented.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. Did Mr. Donis, I saw you came back to the testifying table. Did you have anything to add to the discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To answer your question, everyone that goes to the VA, and everyone is encouraged to go to the VA when they get out of the service. The VA gives you tests. They check for PTSD, injuries and such that you sustained in the military. And everyone that has a disability gets an ID card from the VA, and it's so stated on the card that they have a disability. PTSD is one of those things. I've been very active with the VA in Minnesota and the region for the last 10, 15 years, and the VA is constantly trying to get more and more doctors to help establish PTSD. They're throughout the clinics. We have these C-box, they're called, clinics that are out in Ely and Ramsey and Shakopee and down in, I believe, Albert Lea. They're all over the state, and they're hiring more and more physicians to establish the PTSD issues that our service men and women have when they come back.
Thank you, Mr. Donis. Representative Moline, follow-up?
No, Mr. Chair, that was some helpful information provided, but if we could just get clarity on exactly, you know, who this tax credit would apply to in regard to issues such as those, I would appreciate that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Detmer. I know we've had a common mind in trying to get this accomplished. And I just had a comment on one difference that I've noticed between your bill and my bill that might be of benefit to the committee to be aware of, in addition to the 9/11 language. In my bill, House File 10, it does have a small section that clarifies that if you do not request the credit in the year that you hired the veteran for that taxable year, you have one additional year to be able to claim that credit. We created that cushion in case an employee was hired, say, in December, and that gives just a little bit more flexibility for the employer. So going forward, I think there's good ideas in both bills and looking at the 9/11 veteran language and then also looking at the flexibility in my bill. So I look forward to seeing what comes out if we're able to get something incorporated in the tax omnibus bill. And I did really appreciate Representative Moline's point about the PTSD. I think we need to make sure that that's clarified. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wills. Any other questions of committee members? If not, I will renew my motion for House File 125 for possible inclusion in a tax omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and also Chair Davis for allowing me to go first. I'm heading over to the Veterans Affairs Building where we have the first shot that was fired during World War II. We have a ceremony over there for the cannon that was used on the USS Ward. Okay. And there's a ceremony going on over there now. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Okay, I will move House File 300 this time, and we'll also be referring to 308. I don't think we should move two at one time. But what I'd like to do, I'd like to go to House Research, and thank you, Vice Chair Barrett, for those two bills there. House File 300. Representative Lohmer, if you could come to the table, please. And then that, if House Research could tell us of 300, 304, 308, 309, 746, the Atkins bill, which ones are exactly the same, which ones are kind of the same, and kind of a brief overview of what they do, and then we'll go to Representative Lohmer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in your packets there should be a table that looks like this that compares the five bills. House File 300 and House File 308 are the same, and they both provide a phase-in of the full subtraction of Social Security benefits starting at 10% of benefits in tax year 2015 and becoming fully phased in tax year 2024. The table also shows the revenue impact in fiscal years in this biennium coming up, 2016 and 2017, and then the 2018-2019 biennium. House Files 304 and 746, so those are Representative Lueck and Representative Atkins' bills, phase into a full subtraction of Social Security benefits starting at a 20% exclusion and increasing by 20 percentage points per year for 5 years Those ones do not start until tax year 2016, so the exclusion would be fully phased in tax year 2020. House File 309 sort of splits the difference between them and has a phase-in that's specified in the bill over 8 years at various rates that aren't numbers divisible by 10, and it starts in tax year 2015, and it would be fully phased in tax year 2022.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Manzi. So we kind of know what each bill does. So Representative Lohmer, I'll move House File 300. Would you like to make any other comments on your bill? And again, members, 300 and 308 are basically the same bills, but we'll go with Representative Lohmer's bill. Representative Lohmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'm in good company sharing a bill that's the same with the chair, so thank you so much. So this is a great bill, which is a good start in encouraging Minnesotans who get to retirement age to stay in Minnesota. What I'm hearing from my constituents is don't retire, don't die in Minnesota. And it has nothing to do with our health care. It has to do with the costs associated with staying here. These same people who've lived here all their lives, raised families, been productive and valuable members of their communities, are now having to choose to leave neighbors, friends, children, and grandchildren because of the taxes they're being asked to pay. Whether we like it or not, it's happening. And we have, personally, our family has half a dozen friends who have already left. And my email box, after I put in my email update about this bill, is just filled with folks who are either saying it's too late or we're planning to leave. So I want to encourage them to stay. That's what this bill does, and I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lohmer. Before we get to member questions, I'd like to go to the audience. Is there now? I have three folks that are signed up to testify on some of the bills here: Alance Johnson, Nan Madden, and Ted Lilly. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of the Lohmer bill or with concerns thereof? Specifically on 300, and it'd also be 308. The department?
No.
We're okay. Okay, if you please come down and state your name for the record and provide your testimony. So I have Lance Johnson, Nan Madden, Mr. Ted Lilly. Now, are you all on 300 here? In general, okay. Okay. Now, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Barbara Linert. I'm a resident of Eagan, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, ma'am.
Do you want me to do my testimony now? Oh, okay. Sorry, I was a little unprepared. Thank you for allowing me to be here. I'm speaking in support of the legislation to remove Social Security benefits from taxable income in Minnesota. My husband and I are lifelong Minnesotans. We were born here. We raised our children here. My husband and I started our business here, and we have lived in the same house for 30 years. We don't want to leave it. However, we are approaching retirement age, and our financial advisor has suggested that for tax purposes we move out of the state of Minnesota. One of our kids lives in Texas, a state with a friendlier climate weather-wise and also a friendlier tax climate. Another one of our children and a grandchild lives in North Dakota, again a friendlier tax climate. We could see ourselves spending our winters in Texas and our summers in North Dakota. Our third kid lives just a mile from us in Eagan, along with her husband and their daughter, Macy, who is a special needs child. Living so close to them allows us to help with Macy's care. Moving away from them would be heart-wrenching. If we stay in Minnesota and Social Security benefits continue to be taxed over the course of our retired years, we would pay upwards of $50,000 here in Minnesota. We must consider toward what other purpose we might put that $50,000. That's an easy answer for us. Macy, our special needs granddaughter, has a trust fund for her future needs. Macy is severely disabled and will need very expensive and very specialized care her entire life, beyond my lifetime and even beyond her parents' lifetime. We are not wealthy people. The opportunity to provide that kind of money towards Macy's future care will be a huge part of our decision whether or not to stay in Minnesota. I ask that you please discontinue taxing Social Security benefits in the state. And if I may speak for just a minute on behalf of the hundreds of Minnesotans who retire every day, please give us an excuse to stay in Minnesota. Please give us an excuse to stay in our home state during the autumn of our lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard. Any questions for Ms. Leonard? Okay, thank you very much. So I have a Lance Johnson, and I think Mr. Johnson wished to testify regarding kind of all the bills we're talking about here. Is that correct? Please join us.
I'm seeing in a while.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lance Johnson. I live in Woodbury, Minnesota, and Kelly Fenton is my state representative, as was Andrea Kiefer prior to that. And a long time ago, probably before some of you were born, I used to know Gene Atkins, who is the father of Joel. Gene is quite a guy. I knew when he was in the city council for the city of Minnesota Grove Heights and when he was a judge. So I got to know Joe. It's kind of interesting that they have my name right below his bill. And Gene and Joe, of course, are different political persuasion than I am, but we agree on a lot of things, and Gene Atkins always got it right. And also in the 1960s, I had the pleasure of being on the Attorney General staff for then Attorney General Doug Head, and I was assigned to the Insurance Division. And when Harold Levander was the governor, I ran the Commerce Department. So state office building was familiar territory to me. I went to a lot of legislative committee meetings. I knew everybody on the committees. Today, I don't think I know a single person. So things have changed. And my office used to be right over in the corner. And I'm here to advocate support of the elimination of any tax by the state of Minnesota on Social Security benefits. It's my view that the tax should be eliminated 100%. And also in view of the fact there's an unexpected windfall for this budget year, you should make it retroactive to 2014 so that senior citizens can go back and amend their 2014 state income tax returns and receive a benefit. Now, why should we grant this privilege to them? Last year, the legislature put a $5 tax on every homeowner's policy across the board. It doesn't make any difference what your income was. You got taxed $5. That went to help the police and the firemen's fund. No doubt a laudable goal. However, who paid for that if you were on Social Security? You paid for that out of after-tax dollars after the state of Minnesota taxed your Social Security benefits. The same is true for the wheelage tax that went from $5 to $10. A county tax, yes, but the state of Minnesota still was seeing that paid after that. Now I see that they want to increase the gas tax. Well, the gas tax is going to be paid after the state of Minnesota imposes the income tax. So I believe that there will be no harm done to the state of Minnesota and to its senior citizens. The grandmother should have the right to take the granddaughter or her daughter to a play at the Guthrie and have a few dollars left with which to buy them lunch afterwards. I believe the couple ought to be able to go out and have a glass of wine somewhere, have a few extra dollars in their pocket. And why not let Grandpa take his kids fishing and have enough money to buy an extra bucket of leeches or minnows? That may seem like a small amount of money, but it's one aspect of what we call freedom. The freedom of this. They have the right to spend the money that legitimately belongs to them. It's my viewpoint. The money does belong to them. It does not belong to the government. And so I believe that the best thing that can happen for the state of Minnesota is to encourage its senior citizens to move about and to have extra money to spend. Extra money to spend will benefit them in one other way. This year, their gas tax on their house probably is going up, their oil tax is going up, their car insurance is going up, everything is going up. So those are items over which they have no control, they're items over which you have no control. However, you can help them by providing them this benefit by taking away, in total, the tax by the state of Minnesota on the state income tax, on the Social Security, excuse me. And there are other people, there are other seniors, and I know a woman who could use this a lot. She was sold a oil and gas program that is defuncto. She was sold a Jackson National annuity, which is a ripoff. And I tried to get help for her and another woman, and we went to the state of Minnesota, to the Commerce Department, and they turned a blind eye. And because I used to run the Commerce Department, they told me I was the only person that complained. But 70 other people did not complain. Well, you know, if a little child gets sexually molested and 40 don't complain, does that mean that the sexual molestation did not take place?
Mr. Johnson, could we please concentrate on the bill before us?
I was trying to make it a point here because these people...
You're just building a base?
Yes.
Okay.
These people can use the benefit because they lost money elsewhere. So now to take their money for Social Security is a further defeat to them. So I believe there is no harm. It's a statement. And you cannot cross a chasm in two short steps. You need to take a long stride to get over. And the time is here. The opportunity is here. The state of Minnesota has the surplus. And I hope you all pass this bill and exempt everyone's Social Security tax from the Minnesota state income tax and make a retroactive to January 1st of 2014. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions from members for Mr. Johnson? Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm going to bring down Representative Lewick now, and we're going to look at... So, are there any other questions on 300? Okay, then I will move that House File 300 be laid over for possible inclusion. I will now move that House File 308, which is the same as 300, be laid over for possible inclusion. So now we're going to 304, which is the same as Atkins 746. So members, it's my intention after we've had testimony to, and Representative Atkins isn't going to be able to make it, but I'm going to move his bill forward also. So with that, I'll move House File 304. Representative Lewick, welcome to the Tax Committee. Comments on your bill, please, sir, and then we'll go into some more testimony and member questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Time out.
There was a hand
Representative Carlson
on the previous bill. I don't know if you want to. Gentleman sitting over in the corner there. Wants
yes, we're going to have. I've got now. Just so members know, I've got Nan Madden and Ted Lilly yet to testify. Was there anyone else? Okay. Thank you, Representative Carlson. If I missed somebody, I'm getting kind of old, so help me out here. He's still on our list.
Later.
Okay. Yep. Thank you, Chair Carlson. Representative Lewick, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing my bill, and the big difference between mine and the rest of the bills before you is this would move this process forward a little quicker based on a five-year phase-out as opposed to an eight- or ten-year phase-out. I think you've already heard some pretty compelling testimony, and I believe there's more to come. I think each of you sit here, as I do in the committees that I am a member of, with your own personal outlook on this as to whether or not we should go forward with this. Obviously, this is something that's hugely important to the senior citizens in my district, so absolutely support this. It's in a climate over the past couple years where we've found the ability to raise taxes in a huge, huge number of ways, and it was just touched on briefly a moment ago. When you're sitting on a fixed income and a piece of it is Social Security, you've got nowhere to go except to start pulling things out of your budget. No longer can you do those things. And so this is an opportunity to just very rapidly, very simply, put some dollars back in our senior citizens' pockets. So with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the hearing here and look forward to any questions.
Thank you, Representative. So we have House File. I moved House File 304. I will then be also moving House File 746, an Atkins bill. And again, I'll ask if there's anyone from the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns on this bill. I think we'll go to we've got five bills we're doing here kind of at the same time. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Luke, you have a faster, accelerated implementation of this in the bill that we heard earlier. And can you clarify for us what percentage of seniors currently pay taxes on their Social Security?
Representative Lewis?
Mr. Chair, members, I would defer to our House research on a more a general number.
Sure. Ms. Manzi, to the Loeffler question.
Mr. Chair, just a moment. Okay, Mr. Chair, the revenue estimate for Representative Lewick's bill shows that there are about 381,000 returns affected in tax year 2016. Now, that will include both single filers and married couples filing jointly, so the married couples filing jointly would often be two people receiving Social Security. Now, the comparison to that, the total number of Minnesotans receiving benefits in 2012, which is the most recent year reported by the Social Security Administration, is just over 900,000. So we would have to adjust the 381,000 upwards for the share that are married couple filing jointly returns. But it looks like it's somewhere around half or a little over half of the people who are receiving benefits are subject to state income tax and federal income tax. And I can get a more precise number for the committee. I might have it here and be able to find it, or I can get it to you later.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Manzi. I think there's a lot of confusion on this, and that, you know, the majority of seniors don't pay income taxes on their Social Security because of the way our current tax structure is established, and I think there's been a lot of confusion when these bills have been brought forward and have gotten some people confused about how our current tax system works and the handling of this. And so most of our seniors on fixed income who are dependent on Social Security actually don't pay taxes on their Social Security, and this bill wouldn't help them. It would help the higher income seniors who exceed that threshold and have above average earnings for a retiree. And I just want to clarify that, because I've run into some members of the public who, just from publicity on this, have misunderstood the current circumstances.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Chair Lincheski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lewick, we've never met. Representative Lincheski, nice to meet you across the table. And this really isn't to ask you, I guess, specifically. I guess I'd rather ask the fiscal staff, but since we're on this bill, and it, in fairness, it's Representative Atkins' bill as well, identical bill. Mr. Chair, and I'm glad Representative Loeffler pointed that out, because I've heard people call this a bill that's middle-class tax cuts, and so people should take some time to understand who would get this benefit, since we have a system where we determine provisional income for Social Security benefit taxation, and if you earn under $33,000, I think is the number, you don't pay taxes already. And that's a retired person income. So you have to think about everybody who's retired and imagine what their income is for retirement income. So, it's nice that, has been brought out, because there's, a lot of folks who don't understand that. And I think the way I understand the taxation at the state level of Social Security is about 35% of all the Social Security benefits earned by Minnesotans is taxed. So there's a big chunk that isn't. So, but if we could, if Mr. Chair, if you would permit fiscal staff, Ms. Templin, to talk a little bit. I want to ask on this chart. It's nice to see that these five bills are, all doing variations of the same thing, which is phasing out state taxation on Social Security. And it's nice to see the current cost, and then you can look one biennium over, because that's how we do the planning around here. But for people who might be new to the tax committee, a typical question is, what is the true cost of this bill when it's fully phased in? And so if you look on this chart, you can see that some of the bills are not phased until 2024, 2020, and 2022. And my guess is these bills will ultimately cost about $500 million a year about $1 billion at least in lost revenue when they're fully phased in. And I think that's okay if people want to figure out how they're going to permanently cut state spending to come up with that money. So if Ms. Templin, Mr. Chair, if you would permit her, could, and I know there aren't, you know, I'm kind of just throwing this at her, but if she could give the committee some sense of when these bills are fully phased in, what will they cost a biennium in lost revenue to the state?
Ms. Templin, to Chair Lincheski's question, please.
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. Representative Lincheski is referring to the table, and the last two columns in the table show the general fund revenue impact. And the revenue impact is taken from the revenue estimates before you, and it is presented in a biennial totals for the current biennium and for the tails. And as you know, the current biennium is fiscal 16 and 17, and the tails is fiscal 18 and 19. A few of these bills would not be fully phased in for one biennium or two biennium or even three biennia from now. The revenue estimates, I should go back and say, sometimes do contain information about the revenue impact when the bill is fully phased in. But some of these bills are, they're pretty far out there in terms of when they're fully phased in. One bill is not phased in until tax year 2024, which could be almost three biennia away. One way to look at the cost outside the forecast window would be to take the revenue impact in the tails and flatline the projected revenue reduction in the future biennia. And I can look at that and get back to you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and the professionalism of the House is always apparent, Mr. Chair, because she didn't say a number, and I understand that. But I would ask you, Mr. Chair, as you consider this going forward, and I know you're going to get your target in, I don't know, 20 days or something under our rules. Folks have to have them out there pretty soon. So, Mr. Chair, I hope you and Representative Knobloch will make sure you understand what the cost of that bill is. So even if you flatline them, you can see that the one we're on is $463 million in that next biennium. And of course, you know, if you look at the aging population, I think it's clear that number is going to grow, and that's only getting to 20% of the bill. So you got to go times five for the price tag of that bill. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, and very good points. Thank you, Ms. Templin. That $463 million we're talking about, now I'm not going to call that a rounding error. Did that on $70 million one time and got in all sorts of trouble. So that is not a rounding error. I'll go to Representative Loeffler, but then I'm going to take some testimony from Nan Madden, and then we'll go back, and Mr. Lillian will go back to member questions. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Knobloch. As you look at trying to set what was just discussed about fiscal targets, the other thing I think we as a whole body have to wrestle with, and it's going to be difficult, but over the time period that we're talking about, we are also going to have more and more of the boomer generation retiring. But as you get to the later years of this phase-in, that's when they start hitting the frailty issues, that they start to become dependent upon home care supports, maybe going to assisted living, maybe going to nursing homes, depending upon their health profile. Some of them will make it to their 90s very healthy and independent, but unfortunately that's not true for a lot of people. And for the lower income seniors, they tend to use up their life savings, and then come to the state for assistance through our medical assistance program. And so during the same time that we're looking at this major tax break for the wealthier seniors, we're going to at the same time have their counterparts in that generation, the lower income seniors, who may have just not had as good an occupational profile as the others, becoming more and more persons who need to turn to the state and our medical assistance programs to have their needs met. And it's going to be really difficult for all of us, no matter which parties are in charge, to kind of balance the the demands that are going to be put upon our service system as we go ahead. And I think as we look at these kind of long-term commitments, we have to look at not just this committee's opportunities, but the but what the challenges are that are going to face the other committee that has to deal with people who will have increasing needs and who may use up their savings, as has traditionally been our experience, and turn to a different part of the state budget for assistance.
Okay, members, I guess we've got two more questions on this, but we'll take those. And then why don't we get Ms. Madden down to the table here. And does the department have any comments they'd like to make on these bills at this point?
Not at this point.
Okay, thank you, department. Okay, Representative Grafflo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just I wanted to check with House staff to make sure I have the numbers right here, because we heard the term wealthier senior citizens. Can you just tell us what the cutoff is currently under current law for the taxability of Social Security benefits? I want to make sure I have these numbers right for single as well as married filers.
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, it's not not totally transparent what the income level is. The amount of Social Security benefits that are included in taxable income are calculated under a formula that's set at the federal level that has two tiers of income for separate amounts for married couples filing jointly and for single filers. The income measure used to determine how much of your Social Security benefits are included in taxable income is something that's called provisional income. I think someone has used that term already today. And that equals adjusted gross income other than Social Security benefit, so any other retirement income that you had, any wage, interest, dividend, or capital gain income that you had, or income from a business, plus one half of your Social Security benefits, and plus any tax-exempt interest that you have from municipal bonds. So you take that measure and you compare it to these two tiers, and the amount at which you begin to have some of your Social Security included in taxable income is when your provisional income exceeds $25,000 if you are a single filer, or $32,000 if you are a married couple filing jointly. Then the second tier starts for single filers at $34,000 of provisional income and $44,000 for married couples filing jointly. And at that level, at least 50% and up to 85% of your benefits are included in taxable income. And then, you know, if I find one other piece of paper here, I can tell you how that translates to total income. If you just bear with me for a moment.
Mr.
Chair Grafflo.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I just I want to just make sure that we understood those, that the committee understands those numbers, and that these are not high wealth, wealthy individuals. We are providing an incentive for these individuals not only to take their experience, their knowledge, and their money out of state. We're encouraging them to leave our state. And these are not, again, these are, we're not talking about the zillionaires or the billionaires out there. This is, so when people are using the term wealthy or wealthier, I guess wealthier is a technically accurate term. A man with $2 is wealthier than a man with $1, but we're talking about very modest income levels here, that we are providing a tax incentive to export out of our state. And it just, I would hope, you know, people are making pitches to Chairman Knobloch. I guess I'll pile in here and say, Chairman Knobloch, when you're assigning targets, I would really like to see us be able to move forward on this item. So I want to keep these individuals in Minnesota. I want people like my parents to stay here in Minnesota instead of being offered a tax incentive to go to another state where not only is the weather warmer, but also they're going to pay less taxes.
Thank you, Chair Grafflo. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to kind of weigh in on this discussion, and I heard Chair Lencheski talking about the projections here on how much less of the people's money the state would be collecting should we get rid of this onerous tax for the elderly people in our society. And, you know, Mr. Chair, I think the forecast said we have about a $1.9 billion projection is about the amount of the people's money that we're projected to over-collect over the next 2 years. And so as I look at it, we could probably repeal this thing in a, you know, 3-4 years if we had the discipline to do so. So it looks like there's plenty of room, Representative Lincheski, and both of these bills seem to fit into that. Kind of tagging off on Representative Garofalo's comments on the tiers, and you know, I was listening attentively, and there was discussion about, well, some of these people are already exempt. It appears to me that we are exempting people who make less than $25,000 of the combined income. And Representative Anzels and I were talking about how, no offense, Ms. Manzi, but it sounds like a convoluted formula that's been put together somewhere that, as Representative Anzels articulated well, the public probably has as much problem as us in understanding how it fits together. But as I look at that structure, and then as you go, as you earn more of what is a modest income range, you're taxed more. Yeah. And so we're disincentivizing work among people once they reach retirement age. Is that, Ms. Manzi, is that, am I reading into this improperly?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, wages would be included in provisional income. For many seniors, most of their adjusted gross income is going to consist of things other than wages, but if they do have wage income, it's going to count towards their provisional income. And how much of their Social Security benefits are then included in federal and state tax?
So, Mr. Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, members, it appears to me that we have a system here that if I'm a senior and I'm collecting Social Security benefits, it's in my best interest not to work so that my total amount of income is lower and I have less tax exposure. I think we should repeal this, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And since her name was used, we'll go to Chair Lincheski, and then we're going to Ms. Madden, and then to Mr. Lilly, and then we'll move some bills. I've also got another point I'd like to share with the committee. Chair Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just a couple things. And I don't disagree at all that this isn't something this committee shouldn't consider. And Representative Drazkowski, we do have the money. There's a reason we do. We can talk about that some other time, but we do have the money, and yep, you could do it all right now. And, you know, this certainly would be, it wouldn't even take 3 years. You'd do it all right now. So my point wasn't to do it or not. My point was to be honest about the true cost. And the true cost is not what's shown here. It's significantly higher than this because it takes till 2024 to phase in. So people should do it fully phased in, not at 10%, if we're going to be honest about it. But I do want to just mention that I did not use the term wealthy. I know somebody did, but it wasn't me. And I did that very intentionally. What I said was, this isn't middle-class tax cuts, because when you're talking about, and I said $33,000, but the answer was $32,000, that's retirement income again. So I think members should think about your districts. Don't think about the capital. Think about the 40,000 people you represent. Think of everyone who's retired in your districts and ask yourself, how many of them do you think earn more than that in retirement income? Not wages, not what they earn when they're 40 or 50 or 60. We're talking about retirees. So you can just see then, since everybody under that is already exempt, where those benefits are going to go. About only 35% of all the benefits of Social Security in Minnesota are taxed currently, in total dollars of the $12 billion or whatever the number is. And I'll just leave you with one other thing. If Mr. Chair and Representative Knobloch, as outstate legislators, you choose to do this, you should know that it's a heavily, it's a big benefit to metro Minnesota and not rural. So I might want to keep that in mind as you go through your calculations.
Well, Chair Lincheski, we're always looking out for you. One point that you made, and I want Ms. Manzi to clarify. You said it's just, a single person, $25,000 is just retirement income, but isn't it retirement income and wages?
Yes.
Chair Lincheski?
Mr. Chair, we're not retired when we're 40. My point is...
I could have.
Think about the people you know who are actually now collecting Social Security. Some people choose to do it at 65. Some people choose to do it at 70. That's who you have to think about in your district. And then ask yourself what you think their income is right now. And if you all are representing folks that have $100,000 retirement incomes, I mean, I'd be surprised because the data across the state shows something else for the average income of senior citizens in Minnesota. It's significantly higher in the metro, and it's significantly higher in particular parts of the metro that people like I and Representative Anderson and Earhart and a few others around here represent. But when you really take a look at who's going to benefit from this proposal, I think you'll have a different take on it when you drill down.
Thank you, Chair Lanchesky. With that, I'm going to move, and I'm going to leave one here, and then we'll have testimony so Mr. Lewitt can get about his day here, or Representative. I'll move House File 304 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I will move that the Atkins bill, House File 746, be laid over for possible inclusion. I'll move House File 309. Okay, so with that, thank you, Representative Lewitt. With that, Ms. Madden and maybe Mr. Lilly could come down. We'll take your testimony. And while Mr. Lilly's coming down here, I would have one question maybe for Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi. In Ways and Means Committee yesterday, I asked a question about the potential tax court ruling that could cost the state of Minnesota $700 million. We don't know if we're going to win or lose on that. Some are saying there's a good chance we could lose. And in that discussion, because with we're talking about $700 million, we just, under the February forecast, we're another $800 million, so we're about $1.9 billion. And the comment was made in the Ways and Means Committee that there's a provision in state statute currently that if the state is in a situation like this, that money could be paid out over a period of time. And maybe if we don't have an answer right now, I just want the tax committee to be aware of what could be hitting us here, and it might be into next year. But I think we need to think about planning for it. And I talked to Commissioner Franz yesterday in the committee, and I know that in forecast you can't put in the forecast something that hasn't happened. I understand that. But I think we had better be aware of what's out there. And Mr. Michael, maybe you could help us or Ms. Manzi, Mr. Michael. What provision currently is there in state statute about how we can pay this over a period of time if we lose?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there is a provision in the refund statute. I don't have the parameters at the tip of my tongue, but that provision allows large tax refunds to be paid out in installments over time. Was enacted by the legislature after the experience with the Cambridge Bank case, which was a similar large obligation of the state that occurred. I can, you know, get for the committee the exact parameters of that and whether there may be an issue about, you know, to what extent it would be triggered by this case. The size of this case is, you know, in constant dollars, smaller than the Cambridge Bank case, and I'm not sure that revenue really knows exactly how large the exposure is. They've sort of done some rough estimates. I guess my other observation is if history is any guide, it is going to take a period of time for the case to work its way through the system. There's litigation going on in multiple other states, and it's going to be an issue of, you know, if the states lose, which one gets to the U.S. Supreme Court first, and, you know, so these are all things that are going to play out over a period of time, but I can, you know, summarize for the committee the exact provisions of that installment refund law.
Thank you, Mr. Mike. I think that'd be helpful, and that was just kind of an aside here that we may want to be thinking about that issue at some point here. Okay, with that, Ms. Madden, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and then we'll go to Mr. Lilly. Ms. Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project, which is a research and advocacy organization that promotes public policies that expand opportunity and economic security to all Minnesotans. I appreciate the opportunity to raise some concerns today about the bills you have before you to expand the state's exemption for Social Security income. Our main concerns are these. 1st. These bills phase in over 5 to 10 years, so their full cost is outside of the forecasting window. So that means you don't have the information you need to know whether these tax cuts are sustainable. Second concern is the high cost of these bills, which we believe will crowd out other priorities and put the services that seniors count on at risk. And third, we think that despite their high cost, we don't think these bills are going to have a substantial impact on senior migration, which research suggests is not highly driven by tax benefits for seniors, although, of course, they are a factor. So my first concern is that these bills have phase-in periods that extend beyond what you see in the fiscal note. So you don't have a full picture of their cost, and you also don't need to you also aren't addressing the trade-offs of the full cost in terms of other tax and spending choices. These bills commit to tax cuts on top of what's measured in the fiscal note without knowing what the state's financial situation will be over the 5, 8, or 10 years that they take to be fully in effect. But if we look at recent history, we should not assume that Minnesota will be in a good position to fund new tax cuts every year for the next 8 to 10 years, and that's because a recession tends to come about once every 10 years, sometimes a little longer, sometimes a little sooner. So for these bills that have the longer phase-ins, they are committing us to tax cuts in years that the state is likely to be facing a deficit because of an economic downturn. So we don't think it makes sense to be cutting taxes in a deficit situation, and it does make it harder for the state to respond to Minnesotans' needs in the future when we won't be having quite as strong as the economy as we're having right now. Second concern is the high cost of these bills, which we don't actually know the full cost because it's outside of the forecasting window. But as Representative Lencheski suggested, I think all reasonable ballpark estimates show us that it's a substantial cost. And I would share the concern that that large tax cut does harm our ability to respond to an aging population and threatens the seniors, the services that seniors count on, whether those are the community-based services that help seniors stay in their homes or nursing home care when they become more elderly and frail. And then finally, our concern is that we don't think that these bills will have a substantial impact on the amount of migration out of the state. And that is because when we've looked at academic research that looks at all kinds of changes in tax policy across states for 30-year periods, they find that the patterns of senior migration tend to be pretty steady, even though there's been a lot of change and a lot of variety among states in terms of their tax levels and how they have tax preferences for seniors. So that doesn't mean that nobody takes taxes into account when they're making decisions. It does suggest that other factors, and climate being probably top among those, drive these concerns to a greater extent. And I certainly don't think we can think that these tax cuts would pay for themselves in terms of the relatively small number of seniors who would stay here who would otherwise move compared to the very large cost of this bill. So because of these serious concerns, the long phase-out period, the very high cost, we would encourage you not to pass these bills into law and to take a more targeted approach to looking at the needs of Minnesota seniors on both the tax and the services side of the ledger. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mann. So you're testifying against the chairman's bills, his top high priorities?
I do sometimes do that, but I know we're working on a bill together.
Yeah, what bill? You actually testified on behalf of my bill, and I about fell out of my chair. What was that?
That was the bill to realign the funding sources for the Working Family Credit.
Fine piece of legislation.
A very good piece of legislation that I think you should put in the omnibus bill.
Okay.
You gave her the plug.
Thank you, Ms. Madden, as always. For tomorrow, before we get to Mr. Lilly, tomorrow's hearing, House File 229, McDonald, 1132, Gunther, 1091, McDonald, 1064, Loon. But in my estimation, it'll still be Chair Anderson Day at the Capitol. So with that being said, let's go to please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, esteemed members of the committee, I'm Ted Lilly, president of the Taxpayers League. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today in support of these bills. They are very important to Minnesotans. I had some different numbers as far as the impacts on folks, but I would not change the numbers, or would not give you my numbers that are different than yours. But it does appear that a significant number of seniors will be impacted by this change in taxes should this go forward. And our biggest concern at the Taxpayers League is competitiveness. The competitiveness that Minnesota has versus other states, and our ability to have seniors choose to remain in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is one of seven states that currently taxes Social Security benefits. In 2008, there were 14 states. So the trend across the country is to reduce the number of states that are taxing Social Security benefits. Minnesota was ranked again number fourth least favorite or least friendly states by Kiplinger Magazine of places to retire. This has happened a number of times that Kiplinger has said that Minnesota is one of the least friendly places to retire. The main reason for that is that we tax virtually everything, everything that we do. We have a wonderful quality of life and we retain most of our seniors, but at the same time taxes are a consideration in people's choices of where they choose to live out their lives. One of the three main points that I did want to share with you, one is that the state demographer had a report recently, Minnesota on the Move, and in that report it was basically delineated that a number of that two different groups are leaving the state of Minnesota. One is college-age students. College-age students are leaving the state of Minnesota for education purposes, and Minnesota is challenged to bring those folks back to Minnesota to start their careers here. A greater number are leaving the state than are staying in the state. The second group is seniors, and although the numbers are less, the numbers who are leaving the state of Minnesota, number of seniors, are more than those who are choosing to come into the state of Minnesota in that senior population. They are leaving for Wisconsin, for North Dakota. Wisconsin, 16% of those who leave are going to Wisconsin, 12% are going to North Dakota, and they're also going to Arizona, Texas, and other tax-friendly states. Second point that I did want to share about competitiveness is that when we talk about estate taxes being high and the impact that estate taxes have on high wealth individuals, here we're talking about Social Security benefits, and I truly do believe that we're talking about middle income individuals that this is going to impact. So in this situation, we're talking about encouraging those who have lived their lives here, middle-income folks who have chosen to raise their families here, have businesses here, and encourage them to stay in the state of Minnesota. And if we don't do this, we're giving them another reason to leave the state of Minnesota potentially. And lastly, again, is the competitiveness with other states. Wisconsin and Iowa have recently changed their tax status on Social Security. So again, our competitiveness with other states is continuing to impact our ability to retain seniors. So members of the committee, Mr. Chair, the Taxpayers League would encourage you to support these bills.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Members, in your packets, please note that we have the spreadsheets from House Fiscal, a nonpartisan House Fiscal after the February forecast here, so you might want to put that in the save file and keep that. Okay, questions for members for Ms. Madden or Mr. Lilly, Representative Moline?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Lilly, I just had a question. You mentioned one of the groups that leaves frequently is college-age students to get their education in other states. I was wondering if you could provide us some reasons why Minnesota kids would want to be educated in other states.
Mr. Lilly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moline, I would encourage the committee to consider talking with the state demographer. They may have some of that data as to why that age group is leaving the state of Minnesota. I think that the demographer's report has some of that data in it, but I would not want to be the one that is restating the position of the state demographer.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lilly, I think a lot of it has to do with tuition costs, and I say that because I know a lot of people that go to North Dakota because the state there kicks a lot more in for tuition, and so there are lower tuition costs, and we are seeing students leave because they can afford higher education better in other states, which gets to a whole other discussion on what our priorities are of, you know, spending, and I know we're not supposed to ask, you know, where the money's going to come from, but I just think that's actually a really good example of, you know, if we can't keep young people here because our cost of tuition is so high, I'm not sure how additional tax cuts would help us reach a goal of keeping more young college-age students here. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Moline. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a comment and a question for staff, perhaps. It seems to me if we're unloading our seniors to other parts of the country, we're going to save ourselves a lot of money because they are demanding more services as they age, and if we get rid of them, then we don't have that cost. So you can hold back your, just to be crass about it, that's the facts of life, because that population is growing and costing us more. And you're going to have to raise taxes to take care of it before long. But my question is, do we have, yes, and I'm one of them, any figures, do we have any figures on the amount of average tax input that you, individual, have to be an average of some sort, into Social Security as a, on the payroll taxes versus the amount that is withdrawn after you start drawing Social Security?
Ms. Manzi? Or Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, when Congress enacted the latest version of the provisions that we're talking about, which was in 1993, which is the 85% rule that Ms. Manzi described before, the Social Security actuary did estimates for Congress, and at that time, there's a paragraph in this report, I don't want to read it, but it essentially the 15% rule that said that essentially never more than 85% of your benefits are taxed, so everybody gets a 15% exemption. Basically, what the Social Security actuary said at that time was that most, the average that people paid in after-tax income, in other words, under FICA, under the self-employed tax, was about 4 to 5%. The actuary found, though, that those ratios differ dramatically depending upon your circumstances. So, for example, a single worker pays more and gets less in benefits than a married joint worker because of the nature of the benefits. Low-income workers pay in less and get more back. But they estimated that the highest ratio at that time was about 15%, and that's the reason why that 15% rule was essentially written into law. That now, over time, that changes, and I'm guessing that there are definitely some people in some circumstances that, you know, don't actuarially pay in a little more than 15%, but that's the genesis of that 15% rule. It came from the Social Security actuary, and that's intended to sort of guarantee that the vast majority of people do not pay tax on what they've already paid in after-tax income.
Chair Earhart?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm asking, do we receive back in benefits more or less than we pay in? And I think the answer is, if I remember something correctly, is that we do not, on average, receive back we receive more than we have paid in.
Mr. Michael.
Chairman, Representative Earhart, sorry for misunderstanding your question. That's a
Mr. Michael,
totally
still a very good answer, though.
Wrong question. You know, and I think the answer to that is that particularly for the earlier generations, the Social Security system, honestly, is a pay-as-you-go system. It's not like a pension system. And the nature of pay-as-you-go systems end up that the early participants in that get a huge return, and that's, in fact, like my parents' generation got huge returns. The baby boom will get large returns, too. Your children, my children, will not, because they will be end up paying for the benefits of the current generation, and that, you know, that's just the hard reality.
Chair Earhart?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to suggest that we want these people to get a fair amount back, but we don't want them to game the system and get much more back than they put in, and that's what I was suggesting.
Thank you, Chair Hart. Okay, I have, now help me out here, because I have Carlson, Lincheski, Dabney. Did I miss anyone? And Anderson. Okay, Chair Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll be quick. I wanted to respond to Mr. Lilly's comments about college students. We have reciprocity with our neighboring states, and you know, we do have a number of students that will go over to places like River Falls, Eau Claire, Superior, North Dakota State, University of North Dakota, because of their proximity to our border and then the fact that we have reciprocity. I spent a number of years on the committee that deals with higher education, and in the end, we're a magnet. Most of those students that go over to those institutions do, in fact, come back to Minnesota. U of M years ago, and not too many, but did testify that that question is a wash. Private College Council testifies that they are a magnet of bringing students in from out of state, and a large percentage of them remain in Minnesota after they graduate from our various private colleges, and we're not a typical state in that regard. We've probably got more than most states when we talk about the private sector, but they're a magnet of bringing students in. So I'm not going to challenge the demographer that some do leave, but they do come back. At least that's been the testimony from the higher education community. Some of them, perhaps, don't even leave. And technically, we used to hear about the number of people from the east side of the Twin Cities that would go to places like River Falls and be commuters. But they would probably be technically enrolled over there. But I won't, that's a higher ed discussion. But being that Mr. Lilly brought it up here, I think that there would be a certain amount of information that was lacking, and just how many come out, you got to look at how many come back. We are a magnet.
And a lot of them go to Winona State, which is probably the finest university ever. Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lilly, nice to see you. You know, and I have followed your organization for a very long time, and your work as a senator, and I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about the questions that this committee thinks about, and I guess, you know, genuinely not trying to put you on the spot here, because I think the Taxpayers League generally is sort of, you know, there's all tax cuts are good, so, I understand that perspective. But, you know, this committee, and as Representative Drazkowski said, you know, there's a large surplus, and there are many here who feel that the last set of tax increases, and I know the Taxpayers League came out vehemently against my bill, were not necessary, and all of that money should be given back, and in fact cuts should have happened, and government should get smaller. And that's certainly a philosophy that we hear. You know, both sides of the aisle have their different kind of general philosophies, and I understand that, but, you know, taking just the philosophy of the Taxpayers League, you know, this committee, Chair Davids has heard repealing the estate tax, R&D credits, angel credits, eliminating pass-through income for S-Corps, they'll just be more and more and more and more. Governor Dayton is proposing a child care credit, tax credit, and, you know, just how would you or your organization think through, if you were given it all back, which I assume is what's, you know, going to happen this year in the House, how would you wade through that as far as which of all the gamut of tax cuts, because there's a bunch and they're going to keep going, would you be looking at from a truly an economic principle? I mean, one of the concerns I have on the proposals we're on here today is that there's not horizontal equity when you tax some people who earn a certain amount, let's say $50,000, if they earn it in wages and someone else in Social Security, you know, somebody gets a tax benefit under these bills that people who earn that wage a different way don't get. And I think, you know, just good old tax policy would say that's probably not how you should do it. There's also the intergenerational equity issues of, you know, is this a wealth transfer from young Minnesotans to older if you don't replace that somehow? And can you just comment, you know, if you were king of the Minnesota House, what taxes would you cut this year? Because, I think it's easy for all of us to say they're all good tax cuts, or there shouldn't be any tax cuts. And to me, those aren't really, those are cop-outs. Can you comment with, you know, without asking you to take a position against your organization, but just in general, what is the Taxpayers League looking at for tax cuts for this year for the surplus?
I would rephrase the question just a bit. Rather than being king for the day, I would say if you were Representative Lilly for a day, what would you do?
Mr. Chair, Chair Lisinski, if I were Representative Lilly for a day, that might be a different answer than prior Senator Lilly. Might be a very different answer. I want to be careful how I answer the questions that are in front of me. I believe that it's important for those of you who are in elected office to struggle with the competitiveness issue that you face every day. Your citizens, the citizens of Minnesota, are making decisions about where to place their values, their future, what to do with their future. They're deciding where their children should grow up, where to start their businesses, where to retire, how to move forward, and what their commitment is to the state of Minnesota. Minnesota is a special place. We have a special quality of life here that we all have benefited from over the years. To throw that away is not a healthy situation. At the same time, Minnesota has grown our state budget 12% over the last biennium. Families have grown their incomes in the state of Minnesota about 4%. So the question is, at what point do we cross that line that makes it a decision point for a family to make a decision about where to invest their futures? And that is something that you need to struggle with. That is not something that I'm here today to tell you what I would do were I king or were I something else. But that is something that you face with your constituents. And I caution all of us that we need to be careful, because we have certain populations within the state of Minnesota that probably are making decisions around their supper table about what to do with their futures. And if we don't have that significant benefit of quality of life that supersedes the cost of living here, at some point, families will make other decisions, businesses will make other decisions. So that, to me, is the decision that you all are working with, are coping with, and the chair, as you work on these bills, that is something that you will have to wrestle with and find that right answer.
But Mr. Lilly, I think Chair Lincheski asked a very important question in that, as far as you represent a very important group in Minnesota Taxpayers League, what of all the bills you've been seeing, can you give us any ranking, and you don't have to do it right now, but any, I think Chair Lincheski's question was more to that, what would you do, it's up to us to do it, but I would like to see what your priorities are as the Taxpayers League as we go on. We can't do it now. I've got one more question.
Mr. Chair.
Chair,
are you trying to get the scorecard ahead of?
You wish to look at some of those scorecards. I don't do well.
Mr. Chair, I was trying, but he didn't take the bait, and you didn't get him to either.
I know. I'm a moderately liberal conservative, so yeah, you have okay. to need to clear that up. Okay, with that, we'll go to Chair Dabney, and then we will wrap it up. Chair Dabney.
There's so many places I could go. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for not going there.
So, Mr. Lilly, I'm going to pass on you, but I'm going to go back to one of your comments that I don't think you'll find objectionable, which is that families sit around a table and they make decisions about where they're going to go. My mother-in-law lives in Tucson, a low-tax state, but she has Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. She's doing pretty well. We're pleased with how it's all going, but when we sit around the table as an extended family, she's moving back here at the age of 700, something like that. Why? Because the health care is better here. Mm-hmm. and cheaper. So I guess a question to Ms. Madden, because we always present things in the silo that either is works best for us in our argument or the silo we're sitting in, and right now we're sitting in taxes, so we're making these arguments about taxes. But in fact, my mother-in-law, like the rest of us, also buys clothes, sales tax in Arizona, no sales tax in Minnesota. But more importantly, she buys health care. You want to retire to Florida to save on your taxes? You'll not get taxed on your income, but you'll pay an awful lot more for health care. You want to retire to Texas? Great. You won't pay anything in income, but Texas has been written about in national magazines because of the high cost of health care and, different than Minnesota, the low quality of the high cost that you're paying the services. So, Ms. Madden, are you familiar with any data about where Minnesota ranks in terms of costs of health care? Because these seniors are paying for paying taxes, but they're also paying for an awful lot of health care generally.
Ms. Madden?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I'm not familiar with that information. One thing that came to my mind, if I was wondering where you were going to end up at the end of your question.
Lots of people were.
Is some information I have seen is that many of the states that are often referred to as being low-tax states are not low-tax states for low-income people. And when we look at Texas, states like that, you may not pay less in taxes there if you are a lower-income person. So I think that's also something to keep in mind, is that it is hard to make a apples-to-apples comparison among states that applies to people in all different ages and all different income levels. So I think that's also something that the literature suggests, that climate and cost of housing are big things that people look at in terms of where to live, and taxes is further down that list.
Thank you very much. Given time, I'll stop there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll continue, members. Okay, with that, I'll move House File 309 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. And with that, thank you for your work today, members. Good government all the time. We're adjourned.